from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, just before midnight last night, a strike of AC Transit drivers and mechanics was averted by a last-minute deal. Meanwhile, a BART strike is still looming despite the governor's intervention Sunday night. The recent labor unrest in the Bay Area is raising the question, why are critical public transit workers allowed to strike anyway? And should changes be made so they can't? We'll examine the pros and cons. Then, a bill to require public schools in California to allow transgender students to use their preferred bathrooms, locker rooms, and sports teams. We'll talk with the bill's sponsor and others. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, late last night, about an hour before a threatened strike deadline, AC Transit drivers and mechanics agreed to a deal, including a 9.5% pay increase over 3 years. And only Governor Brown's intervention Sunday night prevented BART workers from walking off the job Monday. All sides agree that would have created chaos for commuters, businesses, and others. Well, it turns out most states prohibit transit strikes, and even California has limits on them. And now there's talk of new state legislation here to completely prohibit public transportation unions from striking. Joining us this half hour to talk about it, John Logan is Director of Labor Studies at San Francisco State University. He's also Senior Labor Policy Specialist with the University of UC Berkeley's Labor Center. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone, William Gould, professor emeritus specializing in labor law and employment discrimination law at Stanford Law School. He's also former chair of the National Labor Relations Board in the Clinton administration and author of a primer on American labor law, with fifth edition out this summer. And good morning to you, Bill Gould, as well.
Good morning.
And let me begin with you, if I may. Bill, give us sort of the lay of the land in terms of public transit workers and their right to strike. Is it generally, would you say, in the country prohibited? Or in other words, is BART something of an exception? And if so, why?
Well, California is a bit of an exception. Approximately 40 of the 50 states in the union prohibit public employee strikes as a general proposition. California follows a rule enunciated by the Supreme Court in the mid-1980s, which carves out an exception for the right to strike and allows it to be prohibited where the health and safety of the community are involved. And the legislature itself, in the existing statute involving public transit, has assumed that many of these stoppages can affect the health and safety, and that is why the law provides for an 80-day injunction, which imposes all the burdens upon organized labor rather than the employer.
And what's the history, then, of the exception for BART, and what else is accepted?
Well, what else is, you mean with regard to the right to strike generally?
Well, transit strikes.
Transit strikes are generally prohibited in most states of the union. John Logan has pointed out in a piece that he did that doesn't always work well. And I think the principal reason it does not work well is that quite frequently the strike is prohibited without providing a real substitute for it. The substitute can be a variety of mechanisms, sometimes the issuance of a public report with recommendations, sometimes an arbitration award, which can be imposed upon the parties relating to wages and working conditions. These are the substitutes for the strike, and generally speaking, have worked, particularly arbitration, police, fire, other kinds of public employees, reasonably well.
And again, just quickly, the exception for BART, why is that?
Well, the exception for BART is the assumption, I believe, on the part of the legislature that many of these stoppages by their nature, can affect the health and safety of the community. Not all and not under all circumstances, but that's why the governor can move to the state court and obtain, direct the attorney general to move to the state court to obtain an injunction on the grounds that it affects the health and safety of the community.
And, John Logan, let me bring you in. You've argued that, you know, BART strikes, bad as they are, it would be worse to ban them altogether. What's your thinking?
Well, I think it can be worse. I mean, I think it's a question of whether or not laws prohibiting strikes actually have desirable outcomes and therefore whether or not they're good public policy. Now, I'm certainly not arguing that strikes, BART strikes, are a good thing. I mean, I think that, you know, we all appreciate that they should be avoided if at all possible. You know, they inconvenience commuters, they do damage to the local economy. But the experience with strike bans in some other jurisdictions has suggested that the effect has not been what it's been intended. It hasn't prohibited strikes. Strikes have, in some occasions, continued to take place. When they do take place, the strikes are often very bitter and acrimonious affairs. And the strike ban itself has a detrimental effect on the bargaining process, partly sometimes by removing incentives that management has to bargain in good faith, to present serious negotiations during bargaining. And certainly, I mean, the example that I discussed in the piece that Professor Gould mentioned in New York, this has been the allegation of the union that by the blanket prohibition on the right to strike in New York, not only has not had the desired outcome in terms of avoiding strikes, but it's had a very negative effect on the bargaining process between the unions and management in the transit industry in New York.
Talking this half hour about the BART labor negotiations and a possible strike and whether or not the public transit union should be allowed to strike at all. And I suspect our listeners want to weigh in on this early. And since we're only going to the bottom of the hour, I'll give out the phone number now. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. Bill Gould, just coming back to my original question, because about a week ago there was an article in the Chronicle and it made the distinction between BART workers and, say, transit workers in San Francisco. Here in the city, they are prohibited from striking, whereas BART is not. And I'm not quite sure we got to the reasons for that difference.
Well, I'm not sure that there are valid reasons for the difference. The legislature, very frequently, legislative judgments are made given the political realities, the political power of one side or the other. I think, in a way, we've got the worst of all worlds in the BART dispute because it's recognized that not only is there damage to the local economy through such stoppages, as John Logan has said, but also when you have these kinds of strikes involving such an important rapid transit system, you're interfering with not simply the economy, but the ability of ambulances, the ability of fire trucks and police to move effectively through the very crowded streets of the area. And that's why I think the judgment has been made that the health and safety of the community can be involved. The difficulty is we know that these kinds of stoppages require restrictions. The existing statute seems to require all the wrong answers because, A, the investigative panel, which will be looking into this matter beginning this morning, has no authority to issue recommendations. And B, when this system is unable to bring the dispute to a conclusion, the only thing that's left for the governor and the attorney general to do is to get an injunction which imposes all the burdens upon organized labor. And my approach to this advocates a middle ground where we limit the strike after collective bargaining has taken place. Governor Brown has urged that the parties sit down and negotiate this voluntarily. That's always the best way. But if they can't do it, we ought to have a system of final and binding arbitration as a substitute for the strike. John mentions New York City, but New York City did not provide for an effective substitute for the strike. I would like to see that enacted here in California.
And John Logan, your objection to that would be what?
Well, just to follow on quickly from what Bill was saying about why BART workers are an exception, in actual fact, it's really the restrictions on muni workers' right to strike in San Francisco that's the exception within California. In California as a whole, transit workers are allowed to strike. And in other states, such as Illinois, most public employees are allowed to strike with the exception of essential services,
police and fire,
etc. But there are a large number of states in the country that restrict the labor rights of public sector employees, as Bill Gould was saying, probably 40 states out of 50. But that of course doesn't, because it's the norm, doesn't mean it's a desirable thing to do. It doesn't mean that that's the road that we should be going down.
Right.
Certainly, the failure to come to an agreement between BART management and the BART unions, it is very worrying, and it should never have come to this point. And hopefully, the 3-member panel of investigation will actually find out exactly how we got to this point.
But the notion of binding arbitration that Bill Gould suggests.
Well, and binding arbitration is often the trade-off in exchange for prohibiting the right to strike. But simply having binding arbitration itself doesn't guarantee that you have harmonious labor relations, doesn't guarantee the absence of illegal strikes, doesn't guarantee that the strike ban won't have the negative effects on the bargaining process that I mentioned earlier. I think you would have to offer binding interest arbitration if one were to limit, and you don't have to entirely prohibit strikes. You can say that some jurisdictions limit strikes by transit workers, but still require a basic skeleton service during rush hours, etc.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones again. The number 866-733-6786. Let's go to Ben in Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi, John, and hi, Bill. This is Ben Hensler. And glad to speak to you and hear your opinions. I wanted to ask why you think that a system of binding arbitration has not been adopted up until this point that could be invoked by either side, since it seems like such an obvious solution to situations like this.
Bill Gould?
I think the reason is that the parties to the conflict don't want it. The union wants to preserve the right to strike. It wants the maximum autonomy for its side. The public employer wants to have the maximum autonomy for its side, and it wants to. Both sides want to move as they see fit. It is the public interest that must be protected, and John is correct to say that my approach, like all things in life, does not guarantee success. But I think of the all the options. Democracy itself is not a perfect option, but all the options, it is the best one available to us.
You say it's not in place because neither side wants it, but maybe if it's in the best interest of the public, why couldn't it be done anyway?
Well, the public is not. Regrettably, the public is only likely to become organized on this issue if, in fact, the public has a pain inflicted upon it. Absent, that's a sad situation, but that is the reality.
Well, I'm talking about what about the legislature?
Well, the legislature responds to interests. The unions are most of whom, although the I think the Amalgamated Transit Union has historically supported arbitration, are not supporting it in the legislature, and those who are indifferent or hostile to unions because such legislation would interfere with the autonomy of the employer do not support it either.
All right. Ben, does that respond to your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks very much. Yeah, John Logan.
I think Bill is absolutely right that one of the most obvious reasons here is that neither side is pushing for it. The unions don't want it. BART management has not expressed a desire to prohibit the right to strike and to have binding arbitration instead.
Why would BART management?
Well, it's noticeable historically that often, as Bill indicated, that unions have supported binding arbitration, and it's actually public employers who have opposed it. And binding arbitration has often been turned out to be very expensive in terms of the settlements. So I agree in this particular case. I don't think the BART unions, I think they would be absolutely opposed to it. But it's not necessarily always public.
Bad for labor.
It's not always the employer who's pushing for it and the unions who are opposed.
And Bill Gold, you're talking about when you say binding arbitration, do you mean that the arbitrator would pick that one side or the other's offer would be accepted in whole? Is that how it would work?
Yes. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are, at the risk of becoming too much involved in inside baseball here, I should say that, yes, I do advocate so-called final offer arbitration where, A, the arbitrator would pick the, in my view, the entire package that is offered by one side or the other, and that would induce both sides to moderate their demands to become more reasonable. That, in turn, would increase the likelihood of voluntary settlement without the need for third-party intervention altogether. Now, in the piece that I wrote in the San Jose Mercury on Monday, I suggested that the arbitrator be given the authority to have a kind of second look after the parties have responded to his selection of one side or the other, so he could allow a little time for them to resolve their differences voluntarily, maybe mediate the matter, and then issue an award which might be free of impracticalities that could flow from that.
All right. Sorry to cut you.
This is referred to as initially in broad terms adopted by baseball in 1973, and I know that I'm risking doing too much inside baseball.
Yeah, well, we knew you'd get a baseball reference in there. All right, let's go to the phones again. Meg in Portola, welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I always hear how the unions need to give back, et cetera. But I've noticed that there's very little push from the governor or the legislature to ask management and the board to give back. And I think they've done a particularly poor job hiring consultants, et cetera. Should their salaries and their benefits also be on the table if there's a budget crunch?
John Logan?
Well, I think, there's a very serious point here about why this complete failure of negotiations have been going on since March. And then when we had the first strike and we had a 30-day contract extension, that should have been enough time for the sides to reach a settlement. And it really is a quite sort of stunning failure that they haven't. And so I think Governor Brown is quite right to have the 7-day extension and the 3-party investigation to get to the bottom of this, to really find out what has been the obstacle. Has it been the case that You know, one side has not been negotiating in good faith, has not really been serious about reaching an agreement, has not been available for negotiations when they should be. I think the public has an interest in knowing these things too, so this doesn't happen again.
And Bill Gould, what about the point of management salaries? For example, there was a story a while ago that a former GM of BART was collecting, I think, hundreds of thousands of dollars based on sick time she had accrued, even though she had been let go about a year earlier.
Well, I think that in the court of public opinion and in the arbitration process itself, that comparisons to a wide variety of salaries are appropriate, including management. This is a major problem that we have today in the private and the public sector, the fact that management receives a very comfy salary and salaries and conditions under many circumstances, and employees do not. So I think that that is certainly something that should be taken into account. I think that the important thing that this investigative panel can do is to, shed some more light on the comparisons that the parties are relying upon in putting forward their respective positions in the collective bargaining process.
All right, Meg, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate that. Let's go to Bobby now in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Question, has it ever been implemented or at least proposed a system in which any disagreement between labor and the government goes to the voters, and those terms go to the voters, who are the taxpayers or the actual, in the end, employers who will be footing the bill for whatever is decided? Has that ever been done?
Yes, it has been done, but that hasn't worked very well. Any time you get a settlement, and any time it looks as though that settlement will be costly, a good part of the public is going to react negatively to it. I don't think that collective bargaining by referendum is the way to go. If the voters want to express their point of view, they can do so with regard to voting on their elected officials, as well as expressing a point of view on labor law reform, the kind of thing we're talking about now.
John Logan.
I would absolutely agree with that. And in a sense, we did have this in San Francisco in 2010 when there was a ballot measure about compensation for Muni employees that passed, but was subsequently, I think in May of this year, struck down by the courts because it was in violation of state law. And so it's a bad idea all around, I think.
Just a very few seconds left. Bill Gould, any predictions for the outcome of this panel and the investigation? Are we going to get a resolution of some kind at the end of this?
Well,
real quick.
It's difficult to say. The past is not promising. The past record does not hold much promise for this particular process. Investigative panels have not generally been particularly effective.
All right.
The 60-day injunction, which simply imposes a burden upon labor, often provides for a heating up cooling off.
All right. Thanks. We're going to have to leave it right there. Bill Gould from Stanford Law, his book, A Primer on American Labor Law, fifth edition, out soon. And John Logan, Director of Labor Studies at San Francisco State University, thanks very much for coming in and talking with us this morning. Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about transgender students and a bill on the governor's desk to allow them to choose the restrooms and locker rooms and more of their choice. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us.